Dave Douglas. Welcome to this very special episode of the Greenleaf Music Podcast. We'll be missing Michael Bates this week. I taped an interview with the great drummer Joey Baron when we were on the road together. Joey had a lot to say about music, about life, traveling, magic tricks. So we're hearing music from his record Down Home right now with Arthur Blythe, Ron Carter, and Bill Frisell. We'll also be talking about Carmen McRae, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Send us a note, podcast@greenleafmusic.com, or visit us at iTunes. Joey requested that we play complete tracks of some of the music that we'll be listening to. So hope you enjoy it. Here it goes. Darren. So we're sitting here in the great Kong Arthur Hotel in Copenhagen. But there's a lot of things I'd want to ask you, and I think a lot of things a lot of people would want to ask you about what you do, and I'm just going to dive right into the elephant in the room, which is, you know, time feel. Like, you have a real, of anybody out there, like, really special, musical, organic time feel, you know, the way the flow of time, and I maybe from having played with you a lot have some ideas about where that's coming from, but I mean, how do you think about it?
Time feel, well, it's been a fascination of mine since I couldn't play, since before I was able to play. One of the first things that...
At what age did you feel you were able to play?
Well, I'm still working on it. but the first two things that attracted me to the drums in particular was the fact that the sound being made from nothing, so to speak. You know, like, it's not like you go to a piano and you push the key down and there's this beautiful sound that automatically comes out. Drum, there's, it's not that way, you know, and to hear people that would take percussion instruments and create just from the way they touched it, I mean, it just seemed a little more striking to me. I mean, you can do that with a piano, of course, you know, the way you touch it, but that attracted me, and then the feeling that people got from, you know, like how, the major thing is, like, how could somebody play just four quarter notes, you know, not a technical feat in itself, but that space in between, how is it that that space in between those notes felt so good? Mm. And that's, it continually fascinates me to this day, and I think that's, it's kind of like a lifelong process of trying to dig into that and achieve different levels of understanding and then applying it to whatever situation I'm in on the bandstand.
But you said something interesting that I think sort of flew by, which is, you know, how does the space between those notes feel?
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's the important part of a good feeling groove?
Well, it's
whether
no.
Whether from a drummer or from any instrumentalist.
Yeah, any.
Or a singer.
Yeah, anybody that's, you know, chooses to dip into the realm of making music. I don't think it's more important. I just think it's part of the picture that people don't think about because it's silent.
Mm-hmm.
And so people generally tend to ignore the...
But when you play those four quarter notes, I mean, you have a way of thinking about making them really feel good. And I don't know, maybe solid is the wrong word, but, you know, when somebody's grooving and it makes you want to get up and move around,
right,
or somebody could play the same pattern and you're just sitting there. So what's the difference?
That's what fascinates me. And I don't have it. Well, I see, from my point of view, it honestly doesn't feel where I would like it to be.
Huh.
You know. Right. I mean, I appreciate if other people get that, because that's what my goal, it's one of my goals, is to try and communicate that inspiration of it feeling good, you know. But honestly, it's like I'm, it's not there yet, and I don't know if it ever will be, but the process of going for that is what's really been keeping me continually active with it, you know. And it's I don't know, maybe it's related. Like, I don't intellectually think of mathematically or you know, the space and when I attack it, but more like the big picture. Like, drummers, I think, have a view of a big picture that's just more immediate because of the fact that on the instrument, I'm not dealing with a B-flat minor 7 flat 5. I'm not dealing with exact tones that are measured and that are part of the harmonic information that's crucial to playing a composition. You know, it's more like texture and stuff. So my attention, because I'm not thinking about, oh, did I hit a B flat? Did I hit this? I'm able to maybe view the larger picture of things, or the whole shape. So I kind of always have taken advantage of that and trying to notice the, if there's harmony, motion, where that's going, and let all of that be part of the equation, the big picture.
Well, like sometimes when I see you playing a groove or a time feel or even just anything, there's a feeling of relaxation, you know, you're breathing a certain way, but I also, which I'm sure you're really aware of and you've worked on and probably still working on, but also I feel like what's going on for you a lot is a subdivision, an internal subdivision of the phrase. Especially like when we play a really slow tempo and I'm watching you play quarter notes. Mm-hmm. And what I'm seeing is a whole world of activity in between each pulse that I would describe as subdivision. And that's why it feels so powerful.
Wow. Yeah, you mean like a real slow ballad or something?
If there's like a long time between beats and you might be playing quarter notes on the ride cymbal and then there's like all this space in between. But what I see as I'm watching you is like, okay, there's this whole infinite universe of subdivisions, and that's why the notes are landing in this place that feels so natural and flowing.
Huh. Because, unless I'm physically just subconsciously tapping something out that's like maybe double time or...
Yeah. You don't subdivide.
I don't really subdivide. I mean, like long ago, somebody... it's a really bad habit I think rhythm section players have of, like, if you're going to play a ballad, like...
Yeah.
Well, it's just like not playing the tempo that is counted off. I mean, from the time I was
like
a little...
playing a double feel or a triple feel, some way to...
Yeah.
Play
to
more
keep it,
stuff.
To keep your place...
Right.
In the rhythmical phrase
being
of
being afraid
things.
Of leaving space.
Yeah.
Because then...
There's nothing to hang on to except your own sense of rhythm.
Mm.
And that's really scary, I think.
Well, what is that, your own sense of rhythm?
Just where... your own sense of rhythm, I think, is where, you know, like your heartbeat and where you feel that if you're playing a meter, where you interpret the pulse to be. And everybody's, of course, everybody's got a different thing, but it's usually in a ballpark. Some people in the middle, some people far behind, some people, you know, a little bit ahead. But in the big picture, trying to hold it so that it doesn't fall down or it doesn't race away, you know, but just you can kind of like hold it and let it move forward, but not speeding, you know, but the feeling having a forward motion to it without speeding up, you know, and...
Or slowing down.
Yeah, or slowing down. I mean, it does...
That sense of relaxation, in certain situations, you hear sometimes players that do that and it just ends up being boring.
Yeah.
But the way that you do it, it brings like a heightened tension almost, and it's not speeding up, it's not slowing down, which is where the thing, it feels really alive.
Right. I'm really focusing on that. You know, like, I think what I was going to say was that if somebody counts off a tempo, like, play, I mean, the way I was kind of inspired, you know, when I was a kid, play that tempo. Mm-hmm. And really play it. In other words, if it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, like, just that, like, don't even, in terms of rhythmical groupings, if you're getting technical, don't even go to 16th notes, you know, just quarter notes and eighth notes, but not a chain of them, like,
right,
a couple here, a couple there, and play, like, play the rests, mm-hmm. you know, like play the
right.
play the donut holes or whatever you want to call them. The give that as much weight as you do the active moments.
But you have to play the active moments in a certain way that gives meaning to the silence.
Yeah, with confidence. With confidence that's where it is.
Everyone knows him as old folks. Like the seasons, he'll come and he'll go. Just as free as a bird and as good as his word. That's why everybody loves him so. Always leaving his spoon in his coffee. Tucks his napkin up under his chin. And his yellow car pipe, it's so mellow, it's right. But you needn't be ashamed of him. Every Friday, he'll go fishing way down on Buzzards Bay. But he only hooks a perch or two. A whale got away. And so we warm up the steak. Can't quite understand about old folks. Did he fight for the blue or the gray? 'Cause he's so diplomatic, so democratic. We always let him have his way. Every evening, right after supper, what stories he would tell. How he held the speech at Gettysburg for Lincoln that day. Ho, 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 ho. I know that one so well. Someday there'll be no more old folks. What a lonely old world this will be. Children's voices at play will be still for a day. The day that they take old folks
away. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a teacher. My first private teacher. His name was Mac McClure, C. L. McClure, and he taught me how to read rhythmical values. And he would do so like he would open up a Haskell Haar book or whatever the method book he was using, or Podemski was a book. Those were the first. Modern reading text. But I mean, this was like very, very basic or any kind of even a piece of sheet music he would get, and he would put his finger over the left-hand top corner, and he would just move it so that all I could see was one piece of information at a time. So it would be the time signature, and that's how I learned what a time signature was. He said, okay, the top number is this, and the bottom number is this. And he said, so knowing that much information, you can tell me, this is what he's saying to me, you can tell me what the first event is going to be. What count will the first event take place on, whether it's a note or a rest? So the very first thing, it has to be on one. So then he moves his finger over to uncover what that note is, and let's say it's a quarter note rest and the time signature was 4/4. Then he says, okay, now seeing what that is, and then he told me that's a quarter note rest, and that's what it looks like.
Right.
What's the next event? What count is it going to fall on? And so it has to be two, you know. And so we would go through. That's what he taught me to do, like to
break down,
to break exactly
the pieces of the bar.
Yeah, so that when you see a rest, you know exactly the amount of space that rest has, and that's how I learned to read, although I don't read so much these days.
But well, you read the wrong chart and still play perfectly.
I've seen
that happen so many times. let's do number 86. We just played 86. No, Joey, you were reading the wrong chart.
Well, that's, I don't know, that was a, it must have been a dream somewhere. But that was how that little method of figuring out like what, I mean, I still do that today when somebody gives me music and I can't tell where is this note coming in. I have to break it down and like that, you know. But that left a major impact on me in terms of like, you know, wow, that the rest really means something, you know. And so I think in the back of my mind, I'm not technically counting 1, 2, and 3 or, but it's just, generally, I'm aware that that's such an important part. It's like the frame that makes a painting look like a painting.
Right.
You know? Other than that, it would just bleed into the surface that it's hung on. You know? So the rest.
So nailing that down is a really important part for you of doing your job.
Yeah.
As a drummer.
Yeah. Just being able to.
Being specific.
Specific and not be hesitant about, you know, where, if you're going to play something, to not apologize. Well, actually, I shouldn't jump all around. I'm on the road with this group, and Chip Jackson, who I met in Boston, was playing bass at that time with Chuck Mangione. He was having a big success with...
Right. It was so good.
Yeah. And he was in L.A. doing a Merv Griffin show with that group, and he knew that I... Oh, yeah, Joey's the one guy who wasn't trying to copy Billy Cobham. At that time, all the drummers were...
Rototoms and, yeah.
And I was still interested in the swing.
Uh-huh.
Like, and people used to, like, really make fun... They still do make fun of, like, that Joey just... Hey, Joey, why don't you go play with Benny Goodman, you know?
Yeah, you're a real traditionalist. That's what I've always thought.
Yeah.
And so he just stick in the mud.
he sent me a letter or a phone call. He found out where I was and got a message to me that Carmen McRae, he had heard out in L.A., he heard through the grapevine, she was looking for a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent a telegram. I found an address to send a telegram saying that, man, wherever you are, I'll come out and audition. And I talked to the band, you know, lounge people. I was just like, listen, get some on the cover for me, etc. So I never heard back from her, from Carmen. But I did send a telegram that was like, just bleeding my guts out, man. I'll do anything to play with you. And then the band I was with, we ended up finishing our year and decided to disband. And I found out that, okay, L.A. is where she lived, and that's really what I wanted to do. And that was a decision that was conscious.
Yeah. That artistic, like, this is
I really wanted to
work with.
Yeah, I want to figure out.
You drove out to L.A.
Yeah.
With your drums and your vaudeville trunk.
Yeah,
and showed up at her house.
Bill Lord, his wife, and I kind of lived together. And they ended up going back to Richmond,
mm-hmm.
and I stayed, and I just started doing my homework, you know, just finding out who were the people that she played with, who did she really like, and I started calling them. It was like a total pest. I would call just anybody. I'd join the union, and I'd go down the book, and I'd just say, just in town, and eventually, make a long story short, I got with her in about 6 months. I met her, and she was having another audition.
She remembered the telegram.
I mentioned it to her, and she said, you know, at that time somebody was kind of stalking her, and she thought, you know, that this was a part of that, so she didn't even really read it.
How long did you work with Carmen?
About 3 years, 2.5 to 3 years. Great. It seems so short, but
it's been a great time.
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, it was. It couldn't have been. It was like one of the greatest experiences.
And she loved having you in the band, right? Because the time always felt so good.
Well, no, I didn't. I don't think I was such a good player. I mean, I would do anything if I could go play a gig with her now.
Yeah, and we would all say that about all of the gigs that we've done.
Yeah, well, I want to go
YouTube
on record.
Maybe you think, boy, if I could just travel back in time and talk to that person.
I mean, I feel just fortunate that she put up with me and my inabilities and holes that I had in my playing that were gaping. I mean, they're not quite as gaping now, but which is why I would love to go back. But I hear things and it's like, she didn't fire, you know.
Yeah, but she...
But she... What she
would introduce you as Smiley Joey Baron.
Yeah, because I was like...
She was happy because you're always smiling on stage, even to this day.
Yeah, well, I just
haven't
heard
either. And that record, it's the San Francisco Great American Music Hall, 76
or 70, yeah. Something like that.